Hey guys, I don't know if you're like me, but I love Count the Dings and everything it has to offer. I just can't find everything I need. You know, I know about Cinephobe, and I know about the mailbag, and I know about Bomb, but that's all we do, right, Amin?
No, we do so much more.
What?
Yeah, absolutely. If you sign up, patreon.com/countthedings, you'll find a plethora of other content, fresh content, extended content, the OG Pod Overflow, the Cinephobe Cold Opens that we've taken and made their own thing to live only there, the Rewatchingtons, Bomb in its full and unadulterated cut, early drops of Cinephobe episodes, and so much more.
You said the OG Pod. Now, is it new or is it old?
Mace, I'm glad you asked that. It is a new incarnation of the old OG Pod.
Oh.
So it's me, Zach, Trey, Waz, Tom.
I love those guys.
Just like we always were, going back to the True Hoop days, we're recreating that magic, recapturing it, and putting it back out. We're talking hoops, we're talking pop culture, and most importantly, we're talking for 40 minutes for free, but then another specific Patreon exclusive segment for every one of those episodes.
Funny enough about that OG Pod, you're getting Tom and Trey on Mondays, you're getting me and Waz, aka Zosny, on Wednesdays. Amin's floating in between.
I'm a floater.
You never know when you're going to get Amin in those, so you got to listen to them all.
And what if I'm not sure what Maze looks like, because I've always thought he's a fat man with a fedora, he's got a weird voice. How can I see for myself what this Maze character actually looks like?
It's crazy you don't know the answer to this because it's the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page.
What?
The CT5s on the Cinephobe Pod YouTube page. You can look at all of us.
You can get all the OG pods on YouTube too, at Count the Dings 1 on YouTube, at Cinephobe Pod on YouTube. Patreon.com/countthedings gets you everything all in one feed. You can link it to your Spotify. And now enjoy the show.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
It's Pack Your Knives. I'm Kevin Arnovitz.
And I'm Tom Haberstroh.
Tom, Restaurant Wars, this is the episode we all wait for. The good folks at Top Chef have moved it up. It is now a 12-contestant contest with 3 restaurants, not an 8-contestant contest with 2 restaurants. Holy cow, what chaos.
Madness. It is madness. And usually with Restaurant Wars, we kind of have a really good feeling about each chef's strengths and weaknesses. And that's us at home, because it's usually 8th episode and we're at Top Chef season 16, episode 4. And I feel like the contestants probably are just like us, like, I don't really know everyone's strengths and weaknesses, and that makes for really, really chaotic Restaurant Wars.
Let's quickly run through the quickfire, because I think everyone wants to get to Restaurant Wars. I looked at the quickfire, which was to create a mousse bouche. It's sort of just a quick check-in with each chef. Where are they in their game? You know, it tells you, it gives you a little window going into Restaurant Wars, maybe a level of confidence, their creativity. They are asked to do an mousse bouche, which is a, you know, the small bite you get kind of in a nice restaurant, maybe a tasting menu place. It's just nothing more than a spoon or a quick dish or a shot of like a scoop or whatever it is.
Yeah.
All 12 contestants come up with something. Each are given kind of the format, whether it's a spoon or a little saucer or whatever. And we had 3 interesting winners finish on top. We had Eric, who I have insisted continues to pump out maybe some of the best food quality average, but just hasn't really finished on top yet. Got a nice a lot of good comments on his curry corn bisque with pancetta and a mint gremolata, which is interesting because I never think about mint as sort of something you would mix with curry. And it just, apparently they loved it. A little caviar in there, did very well. And who else do we have finishing on top?
We had Michelle. She came in with the halibut ceviche, which with the compressed watermelon, because I guess that was also Brian's pick, and she beat him to it.
She won the watermelon wars, and with a nice salsa water, getting back to sort of, you know, it was funny. I mean, Michelle had sort of a little ebb in that second, third episode, but she seems back with a vengeance. I still think she's one of the best chefs on the board. And then Brandon.
And not pasta. Wait. Michelle didn't do any pasta on this one, and she won with it, which is, I think, a really big compliment for Michelle and a good sign that it isn't that she's a one-trick pony. She can come in here and do a crudo, a ceviche, and it doesn't have to be Pablo with a ceviche. He can do she can do both the pasta and these really delicate flavors. And I thought that was technically and just from a conceptual standpoint, really, really impressive.
Well, and we kind of learned a lesson about pasta in a quick fire, right? Because David gets out over his skis, has a lot of confidence, has gotten a lot of recognition the first few weeks, decides he's going to do a pasta, and it just fails. He actually ends up on the bottom three, kind of knew it about 15 minutes in. He'd overcommitted. So, you know, he finished on the bottom along with Kelsey, who's Hush Puppy. It was more of an appetizer, I think, than an amuse, and apparently dry and got
too big of a bite. Too big of a bite.
It should be a bite. And who else finished at the bottom there? Oh, Adrian. What is more unappealing than the raw skin of a bell pepper?
Yeah, that was a really confusing dish. That was a moment, Kevin, where I was like, ooh, maybe Adrian, can I somehow get Kevin to take Adrian off my hands on my team? Because that was a moment with the raw lamb tartare, right? There's not much prep that's included in a lamb tartare. And then you do the raw pepper. And I'm sitting there like, man, I would not want that dish.
And here's my question. I mean, first of all, nobody likes a raw pepper skin. Why not just make it a little easier? Do like a potato, like a togarashi potato chip, and just let it sit on there. You know, like lamb tartare is wonderful. Like, don't wrap it in that thing that looks like, you know, look like fiberglass. Brandon also got recognized for basically a dish that is my dream dish, an English pea broth, scallop chowder. Just that is my kind of food. And so it was good to see Brandon get off the schneid, do something pretty, do something delicate, do something that just tasty, great combination. I love English pea anything, by the way. And this was taped, I think, during the late spring. So you got you had a lot to work with. There's some great produce. Late spring is a wonderful time for cooking. So anyway, Michelle comes out of there with a W, which more importantly, Tom, gives her immunity for what is one of the most intense challenges that we see each season.
Yeah, and usually in restaurant wars, Kevin, there is no immunity because they got to get going. They skip the quickfire altogether and just go right into the elimination challenge / restaurant wars. So this actually was kind of a historical event on Top Chef. There's only one other time that I can find that there was immunity granted heading into a restaurant wars. And it was in season 8, the Top Chef All-Stars. Dale Talday won the quickfire, and the late Anthony Bourdain, rest in peace, gave him the win for the quickfire challenge over, say, the likes of Richard Blaze and Fabio. It was an all-star cast.
Well, I would love to remember what the dish was. I'll eat a egg yolk on top. It's great stoner food.
Yeah. So it was like a cobia collar or some sort of collar. Actually, the challenge was the seafood preparer at La Bernardine he came on and watched everybody take down a fish, or basically like fillet a fish, and you had to use the parts of the fish for their quickfire, and Dale Talday won it with this really delicious kind of like soup, brothy collar dish. And Dale Talday, you know what he did? He got the captain of one of the restaurant wars, and this is fascinating. He had the choice of who was going to captain the other team, and you know who he picked?
Who?
Marcel.
It was brilliant. Interesting.
It was brilliant. He was like, you know what? I'm going to pick the guy who I least want on my team. He picked Marcel to captain the other team, and then they did a draft. And everybody, as Richard Blais said on the Top Chef All-Stars, I watched a little bit of it this morning. He's like, I kind of like hid during the draft. I didn't want him to select me. I was kind of like that kid in class who realized he didn't do the homework and is just like slouching in his chair, hoping he did not be called on. And sure enough, he doesn't get called on. He's on Team Del Talde. And what happens? They win the elimination challenge. They win Restaurant Wars. And guess who goes home on the other team? Marcel. So Marcel got totally screwed by Dale Talde. Great, great gamesmanship. You know, the chess moves were moved and Dale Talde won with immunity. Richard Blais actually won the elimination challenge. He got the prize, but Dale with the immunity going into the restaurant wars selected Marcel, who went home. So that's basically the history of what we have here in Top Chef season 16, Michelle going with the immunity. And you know, it's kind of fascinating what she decided to do, and maybe we'll get into that with our special guest.
Maybe we will. We will be joined by Hershey Ash later, restaurant consultant, good friend of the show, Spurs fan, and we will look forward to that briefly. Let's just, before we bring Hershey on, let's just kind of set it up. Let's just set up the three teams, not two. We have the orange team, which is Eddie, Eric, Adrian, and Brian. Brian choosing to do front of the house. Adrian, who is a pro expediter, comes in as executive chef. She's going to do dessert, but kind of obviously kind of run the show the first couple of rounds. Blue team, Tom, the happiest place on earth, at least going into it.
And
quite a lineup, don't you think, in terms of the roster there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, the team bubbly, team jacuzzi. What do we want to call these folks?
I like team Whirlpool. Yeah, that works.
team Whirlpool, sipping on some champagne in the jacuzzi. Life is great.
Who do we got on team Third Coast?
That was Nini, Kelsey, David, and Justin. I don't think there's a bad chef in there. They're all plus so far this season. Nini gets the front of house. She feels comfortable doing that. Kelsey says, go for it. David and Justin sit back and let it go. And
who is the exec chef? I feel like I never really learned who was named exec chef there. Is it by committee?
I think it was Kelsey.
That would make sense because she only has the blackberry buttermilk biscuit.
Yeah, I feel like she was calling the shots. And maybe I'm wrong, but it seemed like in the actual action, it seemed like she was more of in a leadership role back there in the kitchen. But they were just chilling in the jacuzzi, laid back while everyone was stressing out over restaurant wars. They were at a spa.
Then we have the gray team. Thistle is going to be their place. Sarah is going to do front. Michelle with immunity goes exec chef, which is interesting. Pablo is going to do both entrees, which is pretty ambitious. And then they got Brandon on dessert and kind of wise man. It was very interesting, and we'll talk about this. Another car in sort of gossiping while they were running around doing errands, kind of were speculating that Pablo's stubbornness might get him in trouble on the gray team, and that Brandon was called by Kelsey really freaking smart. And I think we're starting – I have turned 180 on Brandon. Seems like a rationalist. You know, again, I don't know if he's one of the five most talented chefs in the group, but it continues to dispense smart advice in a rational way.
Yeah, and I thought the first episode, it kind of felt like they were painting him as the villain. But if you didn't watch the first episode, I think Brandon would seem like just a regular top contender here.
With a nice smile.
Yeah, with a nice smile and gives really, really thoughtful, strong advice. And so you would actually have the opposite feeling where you'd think that he was very helpful. And he didn't, if you just watched the first episode, you'd have been like, oh, if it's Restaurant Wars and Brandon is alive, he is definitely going to be the executive chef. There's no way that he's going to be a line cook for Restaurant Wars. He's going to be the alpha. He's going to want to be front of house or executive chef. And that's not really the case here. And I thought that was kind of telling about Brandon's growth in this season, where it just feels like whatever first impression we had of Brandon, he has totally shed that skin.
Right. And by the way, again, he's been empowering Michelle to kind of really be louder, which I think is a good kind of coach move. Gave some advice to Pablo to sort of reduce the workload, maybe braise the apples in his dish. Pablo's a little concerned that would, kind of sort of eliminate some of the acidity that you need for the dish. We're going to be very interesting to see. We'll talk to Hershey shortly. Sarah at front of the house. But as we go in and as we bring Hershey on, the chaos is just starting to bubble up, and what is shaping to be kind of a very interesting contest. And the happiest team on earth, by the way, as the yes. restaurant is about to open, it's kind of like the NBA, Tom. Nobody thinks they're a dysfunctional team when they arrive at training camp, right? Everybody thinks this is the year we've sort
everyone's
of
undefeated.
Everyone's undefeated. Everyone thinks they've got a locker room that's going to work. No one ever thinks they have chemistry issues until they actually arrive. Let's bring on Hershey Ash.
Let's do it.
We are joined now by friend of the show, Hershey Ash, who is a professional restaurant consultant, the guy we go to really get into the weeds on restaurant wars. He knows things we do not.
Welcome back.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. How are you all doing?
Exceptionally well.
Yeah, I'm excited. I got a lot of notes here. I don't know if I can read them all because my handwriting is very serial murderer at the moment, but we'll give it a bell.
It looks like Brian's service guide.
Yes. I was just going to say that. I'm so glad you picked up on that. Let's start from the top here. Restaurant Wars, 3 restaurants for 12 people. You've been watching this Top Chef season, so you know everybody. What is going to be the difference between, you're 8 weeks into a Top Chef, have to open 2 restaurants versus you're just 4 weeks into it and you have to open up a restaurant? What did you think about just the idea of having 3 restaurants versus 2 and that whole change up for this season?
So the first thing I like is doing it early, and it's just really just human nature. So we meet people and we're polite, right? And you're nice. Yep. And then as you get to know them, you learn that you don't like them and the niceties go away. So they're still in that early stage of where everyone's trying really hard to be nice to each other, which is false. So that actually begs very entertaining time to do it early, before people have worked out who they really do or don't like, or perhaps they have, but it certainly looks like it. I also think the other thing, this is like a little sideways answer, but I want to get to this off the top because I, big fan of the show, as you guys know, but your show in particular, the pod. And I heard you guys discussing last week how, pastry chefs a bit unfair of a challenge to give a chef, because it's not necessarily in their wheelhouse. I think Kevin said that. And I do agree with that. I do think, though, with Restaurant Wars, I understand it's very entertaining and it's fun to watch. I don't really know. Does it matter if a chef has front of house skills? In fact, I think it doesn't matter at all. So I think so many of the challenges that they're going to come up against are possibly a little bit unfair for judging them as chefs, especially. This is my first hot take on it. The producers clearly sabotaged the hell out of them by the starter they provided are useless, just useless.
I want to have a question for Tom. Do you know, can we go back through the analytics? When people get eliminated, are they typically either the exec chef or front of the house? Do I have that correct?
Yes, this is a great question, yeah. Kevin, and I'm going straight to the tape at topchefstats.com. The proprietor at topchefstats.com, she came on to the show last year, Lynn. You can find her at Lynn and Tonic. That is a play on gin and tonic. So LYNNANDTONIC. Shout out to
Lynn. Bless you, Lynn. Bless you.
She is just an angel for putting together Top Chef analytics, basically. And in her Restaurant Wars section, Hershey, there were 30 total restaurants, and there have been 15 eliminations, okay? So 15 eliminations. Of those eliminated roles, 6 of them were executive chef, 5 of them were front of house, and 4 of them were the line cooks. And that is interesting for a couple of reasons. One is there's multiple line cooks every season. So, there's a disproportionate number of line cooks that don't get eliminated. So that's the safe route.
It's almost really like, it's almost like two, if you want to really break it down, right? Like two line cook number one and two line cook number twos.
Right. And there's really, so if you want to get eliminated, you don't want, if you don't want to get eliminated, you don't want to be the exec chef. However, if you want to win, the executive chef has 5 wins, the front of house has 4 wins, and the line cooks have 5 wins. So if you cut that in half,
right,
it's like 2.5 wins for line
You're half as likely to win if you were a line chef versus an exec chef, basically.
Right. In other words, 73% of the executive chefs either are eliminated or win, then 60% of the front of house either are eliminated or win, and then just 30% of the line cooks either are eliminated or winning. So if you want to have the high risk, high reward position, it's the executive chef. And that kind of makes sense, doesn't it, Hershey?
I think it does. I think that that is where they should be judged. I mean, I think game theory would tell you that the best place to be then is the line cooks, no? Yes. Because no harm, no foul. You live to fight another week. But I think, I think. Listen, this is maybe getting off track and giving my opinion, but I think they can still have a super interesting and dramatic show if they were to turn up and say, "Cool, each team gets an experienced front of house person and a team that his or her has worked with before in a restaurant, and then therefore we're just looking at their capabilities to run a kitchen," which is really what we're worried
about. It's almost like a hitter is now being asked to pitch.
Yeah.
You're saying it's just not really part of their repertoire as a chef.
Their skill set. And you really see it when – that's not to say – the better analog is this. The better analog is, do you remember when Dwight Howard told us he was rehabilitating his career because he was learning how to shoot threes? And we all said, there's no need for you to do that, Dwight. We need you to – I don't know, make fart jokes and stand on the post. So rebound. So the perfect analog to that is, I believe his name is that Brian, the Pompadour fellow,
who said
that he stayed up all night to write a reservation book plan. So I watched that with my wonderful wife, Bridget, and she looked over at me because she's heard me complain many, many, many times over many years about chefs who have to come in and give their opinion on reservation books. It's just horrifying, but it is. It's exactly that. It's.
Can you give us a 101 on what a reservation book is?
Yeah, sure. So reservation book is what is. Well, a reservation book is essentially where you take all the reservations and you assign them in at the times that they're coming in. But what he would be referring to is if you ask a chef how many tables he would like to seat at 7 o'clock, for example, he will tell you one, and then he would like to see another table at 7:30 maybe, and then maybe a third table at 8 o'clock. Now, obviously, that's not a very good way to make money in a restaurant, but it's also not a very good way to draw atmosphere. And so if you ask front of house, they like to, you know, get a lot of tables in so that there's atmosphere. To me, that's immediately a red flag. A chef who's like, he's harbored all this ill will over years, you know, jealous that he hasn't been able to assign minimal, you know, too spaced out is probably a better way to put it. And so the notion of him staying up all night, A, to write steps of service, which he never taught, and then also to put together a reservation book is horrifying to me because really that's, again, that's Dwight shooting threes. Like, I don't know if anyone really wants that.
All right, so it's interesting to me. I would actually modify – I still think there's value in a chef knowing how to manage, but what if they brought in like servers from their history that they've worked with? That would be a cool thing. Like, and not everybody, they can still have some incompetence, but maybe like have we, you know how they kind of will present a surprise sous chef sometimes, person you work with or mom or whatever.
Your boss or whatever.
Wouldn't that be cool if they just sort of said, hey, Brian, here's the guy you worked with in wherever he lives, Boston or whatever.
I reckon. Wouldn't that be interesting? Wouldn't that be great? Yeah. And you could see how they work in relationships. And then the challenges, I mean, I guess we're rewriting the show here, but then the challenges could be certain, you know, difficult customers or certain difficult situations and challenging them that way. I don't know, just a thought.
Yeah. Well, I'd imagine it's kind of like a coach coming into the season and having like a playbook that is like the Bible, just like hundreds and hundreds of pages, and expecting every one of the players to memorize it before the game. And then the game rolls out and they realize, oh no, one of my guys is hurt. And then the other guy has to fill in this position. And now I have to improv.
Or it's Dennis Smith Jr.
Yeah.
Where it's just maybe he's not going to pay attention and go with the play calls. So I think what would you have done? Let's say you are on his team. You are either Adrian, Eddie, or Eric, and you see that Brian is, yes, taking a leadership role, which is nice, in writing out this whole plan. But how would you coach him to say, or what would you say to him to be like, hey, actually, I love the effort, but let's channel this in a different way?
Yeah, so, I mean, you pretty much do what you just said. And the way to channel is to say, look, all we're trying to do is make sure that everyone that comes in here has a good time and eats good food. And that seems really reductive, but that's what it is. So focusing on the minutiae of the steps and of the procedure and the step-by-step will get you away from, I guess, the warmness and the enjoyment of it, and takes it into this very cut and dry thing, which, to be fair, very cut and dry steps and service can work if you have a month or two with the individuals in question that you can go through this. So the smarter thing to do is to say, look, these people are coming in. It's not as important to them as it is to me, which is a reality for owners of restaurants everywhere. In fact, you know, no one ever cares about your own restaurant as much as you do, right? Even the most dedicated staff member. So the way for them to look at it is, no one cares about me winning this challenge as much as we do, the people on the team. These people have come in, they're going to work, they're going to have a bit of fun, maybe they're going to get on television. Let's keep it fun, let's keep it light, let's keep it really, really simple. And that's something that they can execute and something we can execute. You know, to take the basketball analogy that Kevin just used, it would be the coach just got fired, I'm taking over a new team, I'm not going to run really, really complex hammer sets. We're just going to come in and do a lot of high screen roll and, you know, work it out that way.
All right. So, Hershey, now that you've seen the episode and yes, they've set the table, so to speak, give me your top red flags. You're watching the orange, blue, and gray teams. What is just standing out to you as the most rank your most combustible situations going into next week?
Okay, so I love this question. I'm so happy you asked it. So they're going to be like random red flags, I guess. Maybe these apply to the show, maybe they don't.
What thing made your skin crawl the most?
There's actually something that made my throat crawl. So that, like, specifically. So I'll go with skin crawl was, first note here, Pablo is the chef from your old hometown, Tom, I believe. Mm-hmm. This is what my note says: can't handle a strong woman. So I believe that his head chef was who's his head chef?
Michelle.
Michelle.
She's not, but Sarah's kind of sort of the oomph behind that team, right?
Yes. Right. So he got very, very, you know, we see this a lot, unfortunately, in a number of industries, yeah, but we see this a lot in our industry. So to me, that's a major red flag. It's obviously an indictment. You know, I'm stereotyping here perhaps of him, but it's an indictment of him as a professional, because you need to be able to take direction from, doesn't matter the gender. But I think it's also very combustible in that situation, because at some point if he's going to have problems, he's going to have problems taking direction from the person he needs to take direction from. The other thing that made my throat crawl was whoever's decision it was to name a restaurant Thistle. God almighty. Can I read you something quickly? Because I did a little bit of prep. This is from the Old Farmer's Almanac on the website. The Scottish thistle sports purple flowers and prickly leaves and has become the national emblem of Scotland. Legend has it that in the 10th century, the invading Danes gave themselves away by their screams when they tried to steal away barefoot through a dry moat full of thistles. Thistles are like uncomfortable. They sting. Why are you naming your restaurant after something like that? That's a red flag for me. It's a very stylistic red flag. That's a red
flag. It's like naming a porcupine.
Ridiculous. This is a personal thing here. This is we'll probably get pushback on this. I just don't trust a chef who's obsessed with front of house as much as Brian is. I just don't. That concerns me. So that's a major red flag in terms of that team's ability. Because, I mean, it goes back to the Dwight analogy. You should really, if you are looking for things that are outside your lane that you're an obsession with, it tells me that you have no concentration and focus on the thing that you should be an expert at. So that line last week that he used about, oh, I'm a butcher, what do I know about dessert? So that's a double-edged sword, right? You can say that that's acceptable, or you can say it as like, well, then why are you on Top Chef? Why aren't you on Top Butcher? You know, so it kind of indicates
this is not Top Scallop. It is not Top Butcher.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. So, you know, there are elements of, for me, that's a thing I don't trust. It tells me that you're looking for distraction instead of being able to focus on the thing that you want to focus on. You know, a chef should say to me, I don't want to be front of house. A chef should say to me, I want to be a chef. I
think right. However, like I feel for Brian in the sense that front of house is the only one who's outside of that bubble in the kitchen. And I know that chef is supposed to be in the kitchen, but the idea is this is Restaurant Wars. And if you can imprint your understanding and your concept of a restaurant on the judges, you can win this challenge. If you want to set the mood and set the menu and set the reservation book, that to me is an indication that you are trying to wrap your arms around this elimination challenge and you want to win it.
Yeah, Hirsch, I want to push back a little bit. Okay. All right, so there are a couple considerations. One is someone has to do it. Someone has to do it. That's secondly is I think we've seen in this show and hell. I mean, as somebody who eats out as somebody without children, I get to eat out pretty much, you know, 3-4 times a week. It seems like, you know, when you walk in to to use the NBA analogy, it's like walking into a locker room with good culture. And I have seen on the show that a calming influence, someone, and look, these are poorly equipped servers. They're not professionals, but we have seen that a calm over a storm can really enhance the restaurant's appeal. And we've seen it season in, season in, and season out. I mean, I've been to places where you were sort of, you know, sort of makeshift in an emergency busy night watching you run the front of the house. It's just, you get the utmost confidence. I'm not going to say the food tastes better, but man, you're just, it's so nice not to have to look over your shoulder, to know that there's somebody out there. You know, if they see me looking for a server, immediately intervenes, comes in. Can I get you more wine? They identify what it is I'm looking for, whether it's I need the check. And I do feel like it does. Maybe I'm misinterpreting you. I just feel like it does have some import, particularly on this show where the restaurant really doesn't have any infrastructure. It's just like it's a one off.
No. So don't misunderstand me. The role, the position is extremely important. That's what I'm saying, because it is so important, it almost sort of diminishes the expertise on it to kind of pull someone from an expert in a different area.
Does that make sense? I got you.
Yeah, but so, I'm not diminishing. I mean, it's literally what I've made a career off. So,
all right. So here's my thing. Here's my thing with Brian. If you're going to be front of house and you're going to write this big old book.
Hello, listener. Guess who's back? It's me, Anthony Mays, your favorite butcher turned podcast producer. And I'm here to talk to you about ButcherBox. ButcherBox is the most convenient way to get high-quality meat and seafood that you can trust delivered straight to your doorstep, free shipping, vacuum-sealed packaging. It's ready to go right then. It's ready to pop in the freezer. You get exclusive member deals and a variety of high-quality cuts at an amazing value. Going to the grocery store can be a huge pain. You're usually in a rush at an inconvenient time. You're waiting in line at the meat counter. You're taking a number. Maybe this place doesn't have a number. You're jostling with fellow customers. You're trying to get that ribeye that you want or that nice piece of salmon. Maybe the butcher that you're dealing with has a bad attitude or something. I don't know. That was never me, I promise. But maybe it happens. ButcherBox takes all of that out of the picture. You are always prepared with meat and seafood in the freezer, and you're not going to find quality for this price anywhere else other than ButcherBox. So sign up at butcherbox.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S, and get our special deal. ButcherBox is offering our listeners a free for a year offer plus an additional $20 off. You can choose salmon, chicken breasts, or steak tips free in every order for a year. Sign up today at butcherbox.com/dings and use code DINGS, D-I-N-G-S, to choose your free for a year offer, plus get $20 off your first order. Hello, listener. I'm sure you don't need me to tell you that we at Cinephobe love our pets. Zach and Boogie are inseparable. I've got two cats and a dog, and Amin is giving his best ass on performance to convince dog owners that he loves their pet.
Hey, little, hey, boy, how you doing? And Noodles is like,
ah, whatever. Which is why today's episode is sponsored by the ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program. For many pet parents, summer is all about making travel plans like adventuring through the national parks, visiting pet-friendly beaches, or road tripping across the country. Wherever your journeys take you and your furry friend, you can help protect them along the way with a plan from ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure that your pet's plan is as unique as they are, because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim, and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/dings, D-I-N-G-S. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/dings. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
You got to nail your actual prep, right? You got to nail it so that you can do your job. And that's what he didn't do right here, is that he thought he could get the chicken skin in there, and he spent way too much time on it. He was in the car. He said, I'm very confident. I can execute that dish in the amount of time, even though they were like, are you sure? Are you sure? And so that was a mistake that is going to engender all sorts of animosity. You saw it with Adrian, where it was like, are you kidding me?
That's right.
All right. By the way, that Ballantine's going to be good, I'm predicting. And secondly, I got to tell you, of the three teams, like, I'm not worried about his front of the house nearly as much as Nene. By the way, I mean, yeah. Let's just talk about Nene for a second. At this moment in the contest, she is the best chef. She oddly chooses front of the house. Now, I get the sense she's a little bit of a control freak, and I mean that as a compliment as a fellow control freak, okay? So I think there is a sense of, okay, I want to make sure the trains run on time out there. I have experience. I'm going to do it. But she's basically getting out of the kitchen where she has romped the competition, essentially doing nothing but a cocoa nib sorbet. Who cares? God. I mean, I do not care. And she's doing a shitty job. Like, there isn't a front of the house as we go into the second part of the episode next week that is more in chaos than the blue team sipping champagne and in a bubble bath 12 hours earlier. Like, she's not. I mean, Kelsey's having to come out from the executive chef position to do anything she can for in service of damage control. And Nene's back there doing her, I don't know, her icicles. Like, it's just, I am floored. She's in trouble, Tom. She's in trouble.
Big trouble.
She is in big trouble. They're going to be two people eliminated. They better hope that that snapper and duck that David is doing steals the show. Because I got to tell you, like, if that team's on the chopping block, it ain't going to be because the blackberry buttermilk biscuit ain't good. It's going to be because Nene is a freaking disaster. And you can see Kelsey just like verklempt.
Yes. I think that team's going down. And I will say, here's my hot take. I loved the spa bath night before thing. I actually think that's how you should go into it. Relax.
The caviar actually, and bubbly. Yes.
It's very, yeah, very Spurs.
I like that. No, that's very, thank you. That's right. It's very Spurs. That's right. Why did they have dinner after game six? But after the Ray Allen shot. But yes. I think it's kind of, I actually like that. I think that's the way to go into it. Be relaxed. It's going to be stressful tomorrow. Get as much sleep as you can to keep the stress down. I'd like that. I agree with you. I think the disorganization from Nene, and she also, if you notice, was very, very obsessed where tables and chairs were going, which... That's what it's certainly edited that way. The time she spent being obsessed with where the table and chairs are going was the time she lost preparing them on the menu or giving them information.
What should she have done instead of obsessing over the arrangement of the chairs? What could she have done that would have been a better use of her time?
Well, I think obviously, you know, going through. So, the most amount of time and effort for those restaurants, you have to identify with a restaurant. Every restaurant's different. You have to identify what's the story, what's the thing you're putting the most amount of time and effort into. That's what you need to communicate to the customer. So for them, obviously, the most time and effort is going into the food, right? Because they don't have anything. I mean, they spent 10, 20 minutes with this interior designer.
Third Coast, right? Third Coast is their theme. Yeah. I don't really know if there's a real like narrative that, that she has to address.
No, but they spent a massive amount of time on the actual food itself, on the dishes, right? So she, what she really wants is her servers to be able to communicate all that time, effort that was put into and consideration into the dishes. And that's very simply done by going through the menu and explain what the thinking and the thought behind the dishes. Because the reality is that's what you're expressing and that's what you're expressing to the judges. And to have a server be able to say, oh, it's, you know, this item, the reason why they chose this item is it reflects this, is a lot more important than, oh, that table looks different over there to over there. I would think in the context of the competition, I mean.
We haven't really talked about Michelle's team so much.
I got a lot of thoughts on that.
Okay. So the great team Thistle, beyond the name of the restaurant. So you have Pablo, Sarah, Brandon, and Michelle, right?
Yeah.
Michelle decides to jump on the grenade to take the pressure off of the others to be the executive chef. Now, I don't know if you knew the analytics of the executive chef, whether they win or get eliminated and how it is jumping on a grenade. But if you had someone who had immunity on your team and you're Hershey, you're saying, okay, I gotta arrange these roles in the most likely chance of me winning. Where do you put the person with immunity who has no cost to bad mistakes?
Yeah, that's a good question. I'd actually put them on front of house, I guess, if you're saying game theory, you know, because that's the area where you'd expect every chef to be the weakest at, so to speak, obviously, because they're experts in the kitchen. My concern with her being head chef is not, you know, yes, that's true that I didn't know that analytics, but that makes sense that she's most likely to be voted off the island, as it were. But
or voted on, like you're essentially like maybe she had some intuitive sense that the executive chef has the most power, has the most influence, and therefore I'm going to relieve them of that.
But I'm going to throw something out here, Tom. Do you know who is the loser in the scenario of Michelle being executive chef?
The rest of the team.
Well, that's the thing. If they end up one of the two teams and it's not Michelle because they goes to the next. In other words, those three teammates, Tom, have greater probabilities of elimination than anybody else in the tournament because there's a 2 in 3 chance that that team is on the bottom. If they're on the bottom, normally the exec chef, you're telling me, is the target. Well, if the executive chef is not the target, who's next in line? I would argue that the Paducah Jew is being persecuted, as is in the long in the long tradition of the people. And because if Michelle is it to blame and it's a food disaster, we're gonna take down I got immunity. All right, who's next?
I would push back on a couple of things. First of all, my resume would seem to suggest that Jewish people don't have a problem getting jobs in this industry.
Okay.
But also, I mean, obviously I'm not joking, but also I actually think she isn't doing any.
Wait, can we qualify for sensitive listeners?
Oh yeah. I'm Jewish.
Not only are you Jewish, you grew up in a Chabad household.
Yeah, Orthodox.
Yes.
Yeah, but I did not perform as well in my Jewish day school as one Kevin Arnovitz. So that's also fair.
Okay.
To say.
Very fair.
You were the star pupil. But the thing to keep – yeah, but I think she's actually not doing any favors at all to her team because, yes, that's true. Perhaps you jumped on the proverbial grenade, fine. But there's also it's not just the grenade. There's also a function to being the head chef, right? There's the whole dance of pulling everything together at once that now that person has the responsibility. It's not just a grenade. It's a responsibility to make her team win. And I don't see her, particularly the volume of her voice – as being something that's helpful for them to be able to do very well. I don't find it to be a particularly forceful and strong head chef in terms of using her voice. And I see that as being problematic. And then, interesting enough, I think they have the little, you know, preview of next week where that comes up. I see that as being problematic. So I don't see her as helping the team at all. I see her as actually hurting them because I don't have a lot of faith, and I'm happy to be proven wrong next week. But I don't have a lot of faith in her ability to pull it all together on behalf of the team.
Are you overstating
again,
that?
I'm surprised.
Can she like speak soft and carry a big stick, as she says? I mean, if the stuff is...
I'm not really talking about the volume of the voice. I'm talking about using the voice. So you have to be assertive and everyone has to hear you. So if you shout, then people aren't going to listen to you because you're shouting. So talking too loud is problematic too. I just don't see her as being that kind of assertive person. And I'm more than happy to be proven wrong here. I just don't see her in the way that, like, who's on her team. Like, okay, Sarah, you mentioned, or like a Kelsey is very good at using her voice. I think, what's the Silicon Valley fellow? I think he has a very
Brandon
dominant
is
voice.
On the team. Brandon is on Michelle's team.
Well, there you go. That's right. So Sarah or Brandon would probably have been a better person to go ahead and use their voice, I would imagine, on that team. So I think it's possible that she was jumping on the proverbial grenade, but I also think there may have been just her, you know, asserting something that she wanted to do. And I think that may end up being a problem next week.
Interesting couple little, I think, potential landmines. Adrian seems frustrated with Eric, who I've sort of painted as fame for, you know, a guy who has one entree, right? He's doing the scalloped pork with couscous and apparently is needing help with reduction from a guy in Eddie, who, by the way, I want to get your opinion on Eddie, Hershey. Like, Tom and I have a firm disagreement. He calls him unsteady Eddie, always stressed out, kind of a maniac. My feeling is he has appropriate fear, in the words of Greg Popovich, and that,
there you go.
Hey, the guy's tense and he's incoherent. And then, by the way,
you don't have to pander to Hershey, who's a Spurs fan, by using a Spurs line, okay? You're pandering to the audience there.
All right. So I'm putting my thumb on the scale. But what I see is a chef who is kind of intense, at times panicked. And, oh, by the way, when all the smoke clears, turns out one of the two or three best dishes of the night.
So I think this. I listened to your very first podcast, the one on the draft for this season, and then I sent you a text saying, great choice on Eddie, and you should have taken Nini as your second choice.
Thank you. They were
my first two choices. Well, you have one each, but you have one each. So they were my first two choices, I think, because maybe this is intuition. I don't know if I could really put it into words necessarily, but just – and again – maybe the way they edit the show, it looked like that a little bit to me, but the both of them seemed like chefs. What does that mean? They seem like there needs to, you know, if you're going to commit your life to hiding away inside of a room, most probably without windows, with a lot of heat, and just stuck in the minutiae of doing something repeatedly, and each time you do it better than the last time, not worse. If you're going to commit to that, there needs to be something, someone would say wrong. I would say there needs to be something broken inside of you. And then we need you to be able to celebrate that brokenness. You know, all of my, you know, I'm going to do one of those, all of my best friends. All my best friends are chefs. We celebrate the brokenness, right? So I think to Eddie, there is something very socially strange about that gentleman.
This is great. Okay.
But he's found his calling, because I'm not really sure if there's an industry that not only suits, but we celebrate that, you know? So as long as obviously he doesn't do anything wrong and hurt anyone or violent or whatever, and he just doesn't seem to me as that sort of person either. So no, I think his madness is very entertaining.
What you're saying here is that the Myers-Briggs test would suggest that there is a certain set of people who are predisposed to be good chefs.
That's right. And it's people who have what they have. So you mentioned about Nini being a control freak. Yes, it's being a control freak, but it's also being aware of it and then learning how to not upset your co-workers with that control freakness. So that'll be interesting to see how that sort of plays out over these next, two episodes. But I do think with Eddie in particular, to me, of everyone I've seen there, he's the only person I'd hire so far, I think. And that appropriate, you know, fear, as you say, I think that's probably part of it. I think also what's interesting is watch the way how, you know, Eric Rappaire responded to, you know, he was almost, it was an endearing thing, you know, yes, you sounded crazy and you were laughing. That's how we look at that stuff. You know, we learn to kind of, we realize that you need this little bit of edge or brokenness to do what we do. And we celebrate, we really, really do celebrate it in our industry. So it's not a thing we look down upon, it's a thing we celebrate. So I would celebrate that strangeness that Eddie has.
That was a wonderful explanation.
All right, so what's going to happen? Give me some predictions on the three teams.
Can we spend just a couple minutes talking about the staff here?
Because the front of house staff,
just the servers, the actual service. So it seemed like Adrian took the approach of like, hey Brian, fuck you. Like you're not even out there. I'm gonna go out there and I'm gonna try to rally these servers. And it felt like she was my CCD teacher again, who was like, well, we sat around and read the Bible verses. My teacher would know that this is, by the way, just the after school Catholic program that I grew up in. The teachers knew that, like, we're not going to pay attention to any of these verses, but if we have to read one paragraph or one page of the verses, then maybe we'll pay attention. So Adrian comes in and says, all right, we have this huge list. Everyone gather around and take turns reading what each step of here so that we all listen to each other and we all figure it out. I feel like she was sticking it to Brian there, being like, you know what? This guy wrote up this huge thing and it's not going to work. So I'm going to even double down on this thing and make sure that they read everything and spend all the time on it, because it's going to be his fault that he came up with this. And it seemed like with the Kelsey side, I think it was Kelsey. She asked who's done it. Done this before? Maybe I'm wrong. Who asked the servers who's done this before?
I don't know. I think you're right. It might have been Kelsey.
Someone asked, have you ever served before, ever worked in a restaurant before? And there was like a smattering of like, yeah, I guess I have. So this seems like a huge wrench in the whole equation of opening up a restaurant that your staff seems totally underqualified.
Yeah, so I think that's probably the producers doing it to them. Maybe it's also they've told the servers to play it up a little bit, maybe. But I think that I have a couple of issues with, I guess it was both head chefs, two head chefs that jump out. I mean, if you say you want to be the executive chef, then be, or the head chef, the executive chef, if that's what you say you want to be, then be that. So if the issue is that Brian is not going to deliver what he said he would deliver on time, you should have been across that. You should have been aware of that from the beginning. And we don't reward bad behavior in my industry. So, you know, the reality is that he put his hand up and said that he was going to be in charge of front of house. It's his responsibility. Saving someone is not, you know, jumping in there and doing someone's job for them is not really doing any favors. Your responsibility was to be aware of the fact. Sorry, I'm very caustic today. I had a little bit of a sip in honor of Kentucky of Rittenhouse bourbon. So maybe that's why I'm being extra caustic today. But
is it the rye? Yeah.
It's the Rittenhouse rye. But I think that, what I would have preferred, honestly, would have been the head chef to have been the head chef and said, get out of my kitchen. You have a responsibility. Go do your job. And then, if you look at it from a competition point, you know, when that item fails, it's very easy to say, look, this was his responsibility. My responsibility was to be the head chef. I got this to the point where it was acceptable. He said he was going to do front of house. He failed at front of house. So I would imagine, you know, putting in the context of the competition, you could pass it off that way. I don't like bad behavior being rewarded. And that's what it felt like to me. Maybe you're right. Maybe she was selling him down the river, but it felt to me like, okay, I'll save you. Whereas you should have just said, look, go out there and do your job, sir.
Yeah.
That's my counter opinion.
No, that's totally reasonable. I just enjoyed the whole reading of each section. I thought that was so golden.
I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, maybe we're all wrong here. Maybe he has written this amazing book that has transformed these, you know, servers into the greatest servers on the planet. Well, I guess we'll find out next week. It is possible.
So we have three teams, as Kevin asked you, and then I butted in. What are your predictions here? We have Thistle, Northeast, and Third Coast.
Wow. This is a hard question. I get the feeling that I have no idea. Well, I mean, it's funny.
It's like, a tough one, right? Because we don't really, I mean, we haven't focused on the food. Like at the end of the day, like look at these menus. Like at the, as bad as Nini's front of the house madness is David, who's been one of the two or three best chefs, is he going to turn out a lovely duck in a red snapper? And if the answer is and Kelsey's black buttermilk biscuit going to be good. Like, and Justin, I mean, I don't know about you, but that guy's going to nail the crawfish bisque, right? I mean, like, does it matter?
Yeah, I actually think the Thistle name aside, I actually think that it'll probably, I don't know. I'm leaning between the gray or the blue team, I guess. You know, the blue team being, just because I think the blue team is super strong. Like, look at that team, Nini, David, Justin, Kelsey. That's a strong team. So I guess maybe that strength will be able to pull them through. But I can see, and I'm not just saying this because I guess we're seeing the previews of next week a little bit in the ad, but it does sound like, you know, I'm going to use an official term here. It sounds like a full shit show is about to happen. Like, it just feels like all three of those restaurants are going to go down hard. And to be honest, I'm really excited to watch it because, you know, that's the dark sense of humor that we have.
Yeah, Kevin, where do you feel? Where are you on Pablo right now? Like, of all the contestants that that were in this episode, I felt the most afraid, most scared for Nene and Pablo, who are two of our top picks.
Really?
Yeah. I could see either of those guys going out.
Well, look, I mean, we've often said and that on this show, I mean, I know with all the analytics aside, can you execute a protein? Like how many ultimate food eliminations come down to that was overcooked? That was my lamb was practically raw. And we've already got Pablo saying that his, you know, the second batch of short rib braise is not as tender as the first. He didn't really have a chance to taste it with all the components. And I just think that, like, front of the house disasters aside, and one of the things is I think all to Hershey's point, all three of them look like a disaster. Like, it's going to come down to, you know, Pablo's short rib next to David's red snapper and duck next to Eric's, you know, scallop and pork with couscous. And Eric hasn't misfired a dish yet. And I just worry that Pablo, you know, is sort of now whether he gets blamed. And here's the problem. Michelle's the executive chef there. So they often put that shit on her. They're not going to put that shit on her. He's next to go. I mean, I mentioned Sarah is vulnerable because she's front of the house on a team whose exec chef is has immunity. But you got to believe that that guy's got both entrees. And if those entrees fail, especially if Brandon nails his desserts, and I expect he probably will, you know, and I mean, Michelle, what? She's going to screw up. The best, one of the best pasta chefs in America is going to screw up sweet pea annelotti when it's her only frigging dish. Like, no. So you start getting down to it. Pablo, whose braise he already doesn't like, I mean, guy's screwed, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean assuming that they're in the bottom. Right. Yeah, because you're assuming that Sarah's not going to run a good front of house or Michelle is not going to run a good kitchen. And I feel like Pablo, if this was who in that group is going to have the toughest time, who is most likely to be eliminated? I think it's Pablo. But the fact of the matter is, I have a lot more faith based on what we've seen right now that Sarah is going to run a good front of house. And then you have Nene and you have Brian running the front of house over on the other sides. I'm worried for Nene.
I'm still weird out. Like, I think of the three, Brian seemed the most capable. He was declaring the sections. I mean, look, this
Oh, no, that's J.R. Smith seems very capable when you speak to him before a game. I mean, okay. You know.
So you have no confidence in him.
I mean, not to go with Bill Simmons. What does he call it? Irrational confidence?
Yeah, but irrational, like, exuberance? Or
Yes.
So, but I think that's what I'm pretending. I agree with the Sarah thing. I think she's the strongest. And to the point, you know, I guess we're a little bit confused at the beginning, what I was trying to say to the point, to Kevin's point at the beginning, a really great front of house can and does and will pull it together. I think what's interesting is I can see a real scenario where the blue team goes down super hard because there's a lot of, we haven't even really touched on my other note here, which is Justin seems to be losing his patience with everyone very quickly, which is, that's also a recipe for disaster, right? So I could see that affecting things as well, like his own ego and his lack of patience, and that could crush that whole show as well. So, you know, if that team goes down, you have arguably the four strongest chefs in the competition going down. So they're going to have to, you know, send one of them out. So I don't know. I think this is interesting. I think maybe this is the lesson for the top chef people. Maybe they should do this earlier and earlier every year, every season.
Because of the chaos.
I mean,
because
this is my thing. I have no idea why you take the best chef in the competition out of the kitchen when you have somebody like Kelsey. And also, often the front of the house person, you pair them with dessert. Because that's her thing. B, it's a less complicated prep. C, it comes at the end of the night once the majority of the front of the house responsibilities are complete. So, like, this is what I don't understand. How in the world, if you're the blue team, you basically nullify the strength of your best contestant Kelsey clearly, I think, I mean, if there's front of the house material in that show, I mean, you know, she's it. And she's doing dessert. Like, what are you thinking?
I think it was a little bit of trusting Nina because she's been such a powerhouse in the show.
Why does she want it?
No, but
because isn't it part of her past? Yeah,
yeah, who gives a shit?
Yeah, listen,
you're the best chef in the competition, and you're doing a fucking cocoa nib sorbet. Who gives a shit?
And I think, do you know what? To be fair to Kevin's point, perhaps that's how she should be judged ultimately on this. That instead of stepping into the fire, well, I guess front of house is the fire, but instead of, you know, just putting down and saying, I'm going to do an excellent dish, decided to jump out in the front, and she will be, you know, possibly judged accordingly. I think, you know,
if I were planning a wedding or bar mitzvah, of those 12 people, who do I want as my planner?
That's a good question.
Kelsey. I want in my kit, doing my systems. Like, I want Kelsey.
What if Kelsey knew that, like, so I go back and forth on this, whether there is some gamesmanship here. Like, do you think Kelsey is, like, there's a little bit of subterfuge there where she's just being like, Nina, go for the
front of house. Put herself, look, if Kelsey were line chef, that would be fine. If she's playing the whole, I'm going to, you know, keep my head down and decrease the probability I get eliminated. But my understanding is she's, and actually they never declared it, but she is exec chef, I think.
Yeah, I left it empty because I was unsure.
Yeah, I was unsure.
I get the feeling that, the more we talk about it now, I guess you guys have convinced me that the blue team's going down. it kind of seems like that. But, you know,
it would make sense that I, after drafting Tyler Anderson last year and then having Natalie as my first pick and then having Nene, who's won basically the last two episodes, that she is going to go out. Hang on.
But, you know, don't forget last year, the guy who got, you know, booted out to Last Chance Kitchen ended up winning the whole thing.
Yes. But I'm just saying that I have this whiplash problem where I get too high on a contestant and then they're booted. You know, like Nene might have been the number one power on the power rankings heading into this episode. And right now, I got to be honest, I think she's gone. I think she's, wow. I think this, like going into this episode, this next episode, I feel the least confident in Nina's standing.
Right. Well, can I back up that, why that might not be such a bad thing? And I've put her high as a call. To what Kevin just said is the strongest chef in the competition. My opinion is that she is. We have no evidence that she is. We have evidence that she's the strongest cook in the competition. And, you know, as we've discussed before, there is a difference between a cook and a chef, right? What we know is Nene can make the best food. That's what we know. But is she a great chef? Is she good at organizing and dealing under stress and delivering under pressure circumstances? Because what we may see from these next two shows is tremendous cook, less strong at the patience and this, you know, the ability to deal with stress and the ability to mentally organize than others, possibly.
And I'm gonna come a very unpopular view here. I think the orange team might win. I just do. I know Brian's front of the house nonsense, but we got Eddie on a crudo on a New York strip, not overcommitting. I mean, I think, you know, by the way, Brian's ballotine might end up being delicious. You got Eric doing one entree. He has not done any poor food thus yet. A scallop and pork with couscous. Adrian, I think very smart with the cheese course. A Madeira poached peach. Like that's a good, smart menu that doesn't overcommit. Yeah. Adrian, for all of her, how do you rate her as potential expediter? We haven't seen it in full action. So, Hershey, what is your expectation?
What I was just about to say is, and this is a vote towards, you know, the opinion you just paid. If you look at the names of everyone, who's the calmest human being out of all 12 of these people? And it's far and away Adrian. She's very calm. She's very, you know, she doesn't, it would seem like it'd take a lot to really put her under a great amount of stress. So I think, you know, as the expediter, as the person calling, as the person overseeing, she's the calmest person out of all 12 people. So I definitely think she will be the strongest head chef out of the three.
Now we have seen previews of next week where she's telling, like,
Yeah, I was just going to say, wait a minute.
You don't touch the ticket. He touches the ticket. But you consider that a strength of sort of just running an orderly kitchen.
That's the assertiveness that he gets at, yeah.
Well, to be fair, I don't remember seeing that in the previous. I might have missed that part. But having said that, yeah, I don't see that as necessarily being, you know, the context is important. So we have to, I guess we have to see the context in with the in where that was told. But yeah, that's, you know, they're under stress.
It was essentially, it sounded like the servers were taking cues from Brian instead of taking cues from the exec chef, which was Adrian. So she was setting him straight and saying, you listen to me. I don't care what he tells you. I am the head chef here. Listen to me. I am the boss.
Well, that sounds reasonable, doesn't it?
It does. It does.
That sounds fair. Yeah. I mean, I think, again, I didn't see it. Maybe she's delivered it in a bad way, I guess. But it's also, you know, it's okay to have, let's go back to what Kevin said. It's okay to have appropriate fear. It's okay to have a little bit of fear of your head chef. You shouldn't, they shouldn't be throwing and swearing and bullying or anything bad, but it's okay to kind of know that, look, this person's voice is important. That's what I mean about using your voice, you know, not just sharing, but listen, my voice is important. I didn't say that you can take this dish. Please don't take dishes until I say they're ready. That's a good, I don't know, line in the sand to leave. I think that this is truly fascinating. I think back to last year when we had, you know, a similar sort of conversation like this on the pod, and it was kind of a little, it was kind of clear and easy to see. I guess it was only one episode, but it was clear and easy to see from the beginning who would win and who would do well. I think this is really exciting television. We have really no idea what's going to happen.
100%.
Gentlemen, this has been fascinating. I am so excited for part two. I got to tell you.
Me too, Kevin.
This is going to be fun. Hershey, thank you as always for joining us.
Gentlemen, that was a lot of fun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. This was great.
And Tom, we will reconvene next week. I will be recording from Sacramento, California.
Yes. And I will be, I think, in Charlotte. Yep, I will be here in Charlotte. And Austin, hey, there are a couple of top chefs there in Austin, aren't there?
Yeah. Well, the guy, what's his name? Tyson won a season, didn't he?
Yeah. Kristen Kish, I think, has a restaurant there, or maybe not. I don't know. But I think there's some top chef restaurants in there in Austin. So
yeah, Tyson from the Uchi Empire won. I'm pretty sure won a season.
Well, I'm so glad you came on, and we'll have you back on at some point. To rehash either Restaurant Wars, or it's always nice to have you on this show. So thanks for coming on, Hershey.
No, with pleasure. Thanks, gentlemen. Have a lovely week.
You as well.
Cheers.
Tom, looking forward to part two. We will speak next week. Any closing comments?
It should be a really interesting episode five.
I mean, the three-way is just unreal because, I mean, we can make a case right now for any of the three teams. And the disaster looms, and I am still, to me, the headline, top of the news stack out of here is best cook in competition, if you want to use Hershey's characterization, has consigned herself to cocoa nib sorbet and ruining the front of the house. I mean, this is a shocker, an absolute shocker. I am stunned. So we will pick this up next week.
All right. Take us out, Kevin.
For Tom Haberstrow, I'm Kevin Arnovitz. Also for Hershey Ash in Austin, Texas, our restaurant consultant and sage on all things Restaurant Wars. This is Kevin Arnovitz, and this is Pack Your Knives.